Okay, good. So today I'd like to tell you about inflation with a Starobinsky potential. Before we kind of delve in all the details, I kind of want to pause and, you know, make you stare at this beautiful picture that we have of our universe. I think it's really underappreciated how awesome this is, right? This is essentially a picture of the universe when it was only 380,000 years old, when our universe was like, you know, a baby. And what we're seeing are here the tiny temperature fluctuations that we observe in the sky. Right? We know that for all practical purposes in cosmology, our universe is homogeneous. So on average, the sky is like 2.7 Kelvin. And these tiny fluctuations are only 1 in 10 to the 5. Really, really tiny. And the kind of, you know, standard picture that we know from cosmology is really powerful. So the question is, you know, if I start with, you know, these temperature and isotropies that I see in the sky, you know, naturally we're going to ask as physicists, where do they come from? So what we do is, you know, we use all our tools from physics, so we look at endpoint functions. One of those endpoint functions, the simplest of course, is the two-point function. So if I look at the two-point function, I get these nice features. And then you know, we're going to claim, or we know from cosmology, that these temperature and isotropies are a result of density perturbations in the early universe. And these density perturbations are, again, a result of quantum fluctuations in the very, very early universe. And the very attractive feature of inflation is that it predicts a nearly scale-invariant power spectrum at the end of inflation. This nearly scale-invariant power spectrum, if we evolve this forward with Boltzmann equations and linearized Einstein equations, is exactly what produces this nice curve. Now, of course, there's not just one inflation. There are many models of inflation. In fact, there's an entire zoo of inflationary models. So if I restrict myself to the case of, you know, single field inflation and look at this plot, we can look at the data and allow us to kind of rule out some of these models. So on this, the vertical axis, we see the tensor to scalar ratio, and on the horizontal axis, the primordial tilt, so how not vertical the primordial power spectrum is at the end of inflation. Now, what we see up here is phi cube theory. As you can see, this one is already ruled out by the data. Basically, you want your theory of inflation, your favorite theory of inflation, to be in this sweet spot right here. So phi cube is ruled out. Already, actually, phi squared is sort of at the border. So, you know, the most simple thing you write down is not quite, you know, what matches with nature, unfortunately, for us, I guess, for the theorists among us, at least. But, you know, that provides some work for us. And what is down here, what is right there in the sweet spot is R squared inflation, or in other words, Starobinsky inflation. Now, essentially, of course, you don't quite need Starobinsky inflation. Basically, any potential.
So what is R squared? You mean you put R squared in Lagrangian?
I'll come back to that in a second. Yeah, but effectively, yes. So, right, we don't quite need Starobinsky. Anything, what we need from this data is essentially, you know, all these models have more or less the same NS, so that's, you know, check. But given that we haven't observed tensor modes, what you need is to have a low tensor to scalar ratio. So you want to have a very low R. So that is accomplished by basically having a scalar field with a potential that has this kind of plateau shape.
Sorry, that's good. What's
NS? NS was the tilt. So if you have NS is 1, good. NS is, so if NS is 1, this would be a perfectly vertical line. And if it's slightly different, that makes the tilt go up. Yeah, so these are, so NS and R are the two kind of like key things that you get from the data.
So the departure from scaling volumes on that
spectrum. Yes, correct. So it tells us that there is more power in the infrared modes. And so how to get that? How to get basically, you know, a low R with a single scalar field. And for that, what you need to do is have a potential that has this plateau. It doesn't quite matter what you do after that. All you need is to have this nice period where here your scalar field nicely slowly rolls down the potential. That's what you need. Now, why do people, you know, mention the Sierpinski potential so often is because that one actually has, you know, a nice origin. I mean, all of us could just draw a nice potential that will give us a low R, but then of course, right, we would like to have some motivation for that potential. And that's basically why the Sierpinski potential is so interesting. Because we could start with a modified theory of gravity. So we start with, you know, the Einstein-Hilbert action plus this R squared term. And then if we do a conformal transformation of this form, obtain the standard Einstein-Hilbert action plus a scalar field with the Sierpinski potential. So that's why it's so interesting. So if you guys in shape dynamics come up with some theory, it would be really interesting, you know, if you can do some kind of transformation, whatever it is, to obtain, again, you know, Einstein-Hilbert action plus a scalar field that with a potential that has these nice features of a plateau. That will reproduce for you the data.
Given that this R squared modified gravity gets like everything else wrong, why is motivation for taking this Sierpinski potential seriously?
It's what cosmologists do. It's nice.
It's well posed,
right? No, it's not well posed. There are many, many other issues. But it's well posed in, so it's well posed in this frame, right?
In what?
After I do this conformal transformation, it is well posed, right? Because after that, it's just.
Okay. Then it becomes like that.
Yes. It's the potential. I'll show the potential, but the potential is effectively this thing. It has this feature, and it's then flat forever. And, and there's an exponential steep side on this side.
It doesn't depend on the metric degrees of freedom in any other way.
This equivalence is only true on shell, and it doesn't depend on any of the metric degrees. In, yeah, yeah, correct.
I would think correct. There would be second derivatives of phi squared in there. You just have first derivatives. So R is second derivative of the metric, so that phi gets second derivatives. So then you square the thing, it looks like you got the second derivatives of phi squared.
But that's not true if once I do this conformal transformation. I mean, it's a very particular conformal transformation, right? This phi appears in the exponent, and that kind of gets rid of all the terms that you don't want.
And the phi is inside the square root there?
No, it shouldn't be. Oh. I mean, it kind of looks like it, yeah, but it shouldn't be. I mean, everything else, of course, this R squared theory gets wrong. And also from a quantum gravity perspective, it's maybe not the most interesting one because this M squared is very small. So this would in fact actually be the dominating term, not your Einstein-Hilbert action. So, you know, there are a few more issues with it. But as cosmologists, people are happy with this. You know,
so
motivation.
So you mean by cosmologists are happy with this, you mean that in some mini superspace, this will make sense?
Yes.
What? I've never looked at Sierpinski's paper or something. What was his motivation at all, and how did he come to that potential, or was he thinking about inflation for good?
This is really interesting because if you look up Sierpinski's potential or paper that everyone quotes, you won't find this potential and you won't find an R squared action. So I have no clue why it's actually called the Sierpinski potential, but he got all the credit. But there are people that actually, John Barrow and many others that actually did this explicit conformal transformation, and they were interested from the perspective of just looking at these higher order terms. Because if you just have an R squared action, if you look at the vacuum solutions, one of them is the Sitter space. So, you know, since inflation is quasi the Sitter space, people were like, oh, maybe this is something interesting that we should be looking at.
So did this come in after the Goose paper, and then they had this famous workshop in Cambridge where all of these things were worked out? Is that when it happened? Or?
Let me think. It's I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know the history of that part.
But the starting point was really gravity, right? The idea was that these would be quantum corrections on the gravity side.
Yeah, initially they are, but you know, correct. So there are two perspectives. Either you take this, you just start with the R squared because you know that gives you something like the sitter, and then you just add the R because we're like, oh, we want GR, and you treat this kind of as a dominating term. Or you start in it from the perspective of, oh, you know, I just have my R term, and I know from, you know, quantum field theory that there should be higher order terms, blah, blah, blah. But that logic doesn't quite apply here, because if that were the case, then this coefficient should be small, right? And it's not. It's big. Much, yeah. So that's why it doesn't quite apply here. But it might have been an original motivation.
It could also be an RIP, RIP.
Yeah, you should also include other curvature terms and stuff and not just focus on the Ricci squared. That's correct. Yeah. Nice.
Oh, is that scalar squared or Ricci squared?
This is just the Ricci scalar squared.
Scalar. Yeah.
Scalar, yeah. No, not tensor. Ricci scalar squared. Yes. Okay, so for the purpose of this talk, I'm not going to debate the origins of this potential. I'm just going to take, you know, this theory up here, say it works really well with the data, and see what we get.
Without specifying V-phi. Oh, you are going to specify.
The V-phi, I'm going to take this particular Sierpinski one, because it's just...
And it's the one that comes from this transformation?
That's the one that comes from this transformation, yeah. But, you know, any kind of potential that has, again, like this kind of plateau and some steep thing on the other side is good. It will equally well match the data. You know, the numbers may change slightly, but.
So the physical metric, the one that the
physical
particle follow with geodesic is G and not G field.
Yes, I'm going to take that perspective that is G. Yes. I'm just going to work here. So given that, I will show you in one slide how one does the calculation in normal inflation. And then I'm going to ask myself the question, actually, can quantum gravity change this picture? And I'll show you that it can. I'll give you an heuristic argument and then show you the details by using the framework of quantum field theory on quantum spacetimes, which is a framework developed in the context of loop quantum cosmology. And then using that framework, I'll show you the predictions of how this pre-inflationary dynamics changes, you know, the way we usually look at the power spectrum. And there are some interesting things that, you know, potentially there are some observable signatures in the CMB that, you know, have this primordial origin. So let's see. So this is a standard procedure in cosmology. You start with some FRLW background and specify a scalar field with some potential. Then what you do, you perturb this background. So you introduce some scalar perturbations and, of course, all the perturbations in the metric, where, you know, I have my four scalar modes, then my tensor vector modes here, and my tensor modes up there. Now I'm simply evolving this using the linearized Einstein's equations, and then I calculate the power spectrum using, of course, gauge invariant quantities, because we're going to do physics with it. So, and that basically gives you this very nice, you know, nearly scale invariant power spectrum at the end of inflation.
So is this one classical?
This is Q of T on a classical background, yeah.
So the metric quantization are quantum.
Only the perturbations are treated as quantum fields. The background is a classical background. Correct. Yes.
Is there expectation values? There,
at this point, yeah, you can think of them as expectation values. Yes. These are just these are just the fields.
You haven't quantized it.
I haven't quantized at this point. Yeah, so I mean, in this step, after this step, you quantize. So first you start everything classical, then you quantize. Good. So that's the setup. Now the question is, how could quantum gravity potentially change this? Oh, this looks very interesting. It looks slightly different on my computer. I hope you can still read it. Let me see. Well, I will just tell you what it's saying. So here, inflation happens at a scale that is roughly, you know, or at least given the Starobinsky potential, it happens at the scale 10 to the power minus 12, the Planck energy density. Now, the quantum gravity regime, I would define by, you know, having an energy of the order of, you know, the Planck energy density, maybe up to like, say, 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4. So this, and this regime actually is, or at least in loop quantum gravity, is extremely short. It's 100 Planck seconds. Not even 100 seconds, it's 100 Planck seconds. It's really, really short. And inflation happens much, much after that. It happens at 10 to the power 6 Planck seconds, up to, you know, whatever you want. So how could this ever influence this period that occurs much later at a much different scale? Well, the heuristic argument is as follows. If I assume for now that you know, these are my tensor perturbations that are evolving on, you know, my FRLW background. If I assume that this equation holds also in a deep quantum regime, let's just take that. Then I can argue, right, that basically for all the modes, for all the large, whenever k is large as compared to the Ricci scalar over 6, I can ignore this term, and basically these modes are propagating as if they're in flat space. So I can just use all my Minkowski results. However, when k over a is, you know, similar order as the curvature scale, then these things become important. So for the large wavelength modes, this term might become important. However, if I look in GR, that actually never really happens, right? Because if I look at my observable modes here at this, in this picture, where this is the vertical axis is my time axis and the horizontal axis is my length scale, then these modes, right, if I evolve them back, because the scale factor goes to 0, their physical length also goes to 0. And if I look at what the curvature radius does, it just also goes to 0, but at a slightly different rate, such that all these modes that are observable remain well within the curvature radius all the way throughout. So nothing really special happens. However, you know, if I change this picture and instead of, you know, go into my singularity but use my theory of quantum gravity, say in this case loop quantum gravity, where I know that a bounce occurs, if I evolve these modes back, right, they won't go to 0 because my scale factor won't go to 0. They have some non-zero length scale at the bounds. And in fact, some of the modes, right, they're quite large, could be outside of the curvature radius because also, you know, the curvature radius changes, right? Because I no longer have my GR equations, but I have my loop quantum gravity equations. So in fact, this tells me that there is potential for the large modes that have a large length scale to get excited by the background curvature and thus have an imprint on their power spectrum. So in this context, actually, you know, it sounds kind of counterintuitive, but quantum gravity actually changes the observations on the large scale in the universe. It's not relevant for the small scales, but for the large scales. It's kind of a fascinating thing to think about. So this is the heuristic argument. Now let's actually look at some, well, this is the point I just said, at some calculations. So for that, sorry again about the layout. I don't know, it got distorted a little bit. So for that, I'm going to use this framework of quantum field theory on quantum spacetimes. And there a remarkable simplification occurs. So if you use the framework of loop quantum cosmology, then and start with homogeneous background and introduce perturbations on top of it, it turns out that these perturbations don't care about all the crazy quantum dynamics that happens. It doesn't care about, you know, all them the what is it? The different expectation values. It doesn't care about everything that happens, all the crazy quantum fluctuations. It only cares about an effective dressed metric, where this dressed metric just, you know, is just like the same FRLW metric that we're used to, with a scale factor that is not just, you know, the expectation of value of the skill factor, but in fact this particular combination. Now, this a priori you could have never guessed, right? This is something that comes as a result of doing some hard calculations that I didn't do, but that other people did for us.
The statement is that it only cares about this isotropic expectation value of the metric division.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. About none of the other ones. Like, I don't need a to the sixth, a to the seventh, a to the eighth, a to the whatever. I only need this particular combination. That's all I care about.
I don't understand why suddenly A is an operator, right? Because you said you are going only to quantize the metric perturbation.
Ah, so yeah, and that's the standard prediction in inflation. Sorry, I'm now shifting gears to look at how a quantum gravity theory could potentially change this.
Okay.
And for that, I'm using this framework of loop quantum cosmology, where I'm saying, oh, actually, also the background is
the entire background is
quantum.
And it's quantized in a regular fashion or in these polymer crazy ways?
Polymer crazy ways. Yes. Polymer crazy ways. Yes.
And it's in every new superspace model.
Yeah.
Don't take
anisotropies. No anisotropies, nothing. No. Correct. And I mean, there is some analogy actually with shining a laser light through a glass of water, right? So if I shine my light through the glass of water, if I want to know like how it comes out of the glass of water, I don't need to know, you know, the orientation of all the individual hydrogen atoms and you know, their individual interactions. All I care about is the refractive index. And it is a little bit, this seems to be like what's happening for these perturbations. They don't care about all the crazy quantum shit that happens. They just care about these particular expectation values.
It's still a pretty non-trivial result.
Oh, it's a very non-trivial result, yeah, that I did not obtain, but it's a very non-trivial result, yeah. I mean, even the people that worked this out, which is Abai, Ivan, and William, they were completely surprised by this too. It's a very, very not trivial result. Yeah. Okay, so given this framework that was given to me, luckily, we note, right, that from now on, basically, the evolution is the same as for any quantum field theory on a quantum space-time, but instead, or sorry, on a normal space-time, classical space-time. But now, you know, these A's are these, oh, also, the tildes disappeared. Wow, that's an interesting feature. Okay, so where now these A's are these dressed skill factors, and this is a dressed conformal time. But other than that, these equations are, you know, if you remove the tildes, it's exactly the same for normal quantum field theory on a classical space-time. Okay, so given this, to actually do the calculations, I am going to make this following simplification that I'm actually not calculating this expectation value. Instead, it turns out that if you choose a state that is sharply peaked in the future on a classical trajectory, right, so just like normal expansion, that is sharply peaked, if you evolve that backwards, these expectation values, these dressed A's, are really well approximated by the effective description of loop quantum cosmology. So, and that's actually rather simple. That is just summarized by these two equations. So here is the modified Friedmann equation, and here the time derivative of it. So what happens in loop quantum cosmology is that we don't just have the Friedmann equation here, but there's this additional correction. And that correction, of course, only changes the dynamics whenever the energy density in my in the matter fields is of similar order as the maximum energy, which in loop quantum cosmology in most models is roughly 0.4 times the Planck energy density. So these terms are completely negligible during inflation and way after that. But they are important when you evolve it back. In fact, they're so important that, right, typically if you evolve the skill factor back in GR, which is this blue line, you end up with a singularity. Whereas in loop quantum cosmology, what you get is a bounce. Skill factor never vanishes. So that is as a consequence of this term. Now, I have described the entire setup. Now let's look at the potential again, just to remind you. And there is also a typo here. This should be a minus sign up here. So this is basically the Starobinsky potential. It's very, very steep on one side, this exponential wall. And then it there's this like slow curvature here happening here, and a plateau that continues up until infinity, effectively. Now, if I want to give initial conditions.
So the square root doesn't extend into the.
No.
It's really back
up. No, it doesn't. Yeah, that's why it shouldn't have been also on the first slide.
Right, that's okay. Otherwise, it's significant.
Right. Okay. So for phi really large, right, if there's a minus sign here.
With the sign you've got, you could just put it left or right.
Hmm?
You could just mirror images left or right.
Good, that's true. You could mirror images. But no, it is not consistent with the way you've drawn it.
Good.
Okay, so here is like the, whenever phi is zero, this is also zero. And then this is the positive side in this picture and the negative side. Yeah. So let me see. Yeah, so to give initial conditions, you know, we know that in loop quantum cosmology, there is this maximum energy density that you can have, right? That also means that there is, you know, I cannot put my scalar field, the initial conditions, at any random place, right, because I have a maximum energy density. So the maximum you know, value that I can give phi on the negative side is limited by minus 0.470 Planck mass. And anything after that would not be consistent with loop quantum cosmology. On the right-hand side, I could put it basically anywhere because this is well below the energy density, the maximum energy density that we have. Now, there's two special times that I've also marked here. So phi end is really where basically inflation ends. Not a very original name. And phi star is where the pivot skill exits the horizon, which the pivot mode in cosmology is sort of the mode that the observations are done. So in this case, for the Planck data, it has been done at k star equals 0.002 megaparsec inverse. Or actually, that was WMAP, but I've used that skill also for the Planck data. So this is basically when that skill exits the horizon, and then after that point, there's roughly like 58 e-folds that happen between here and here. So inflation, in principle, could last much longer than these 58 e-folds. So, but whenever it reaches here, there's another 58 e-folds until the end of inflation. OK, so given that, let's look at the initial data service, right? So I'm going to give initial conditions at the bounds, which seems like a natural time within loop quantum cosmology. And the bounds is given by, you know, this constant energy density service, which is just, you know, kinetic energy plus potential energy. And in phi dot space, it has this shape that essentially continues on forever. Now, the blue ones, if I were to give, say, initial conditions here, their trajectory goes up like this and settles around zero here. And they turn out not to have enough inflation. So from an observational perspective, they're ruled out. They won't give you the nice things that you need for inflation to be so successful. However, all the red starting points, they lead to inflation. In fact, so the ones here give you exactly like, you know, the 58 e-folds that you need. And anything up there increases the number of e-folds. Similarly here, here you get 58. And anything up there just increases it. And this line, right, continues all the way until infinity. So what this tells you is basically that from if you treat all these initial conditions equally, inflation is bound to happen practically, right? Because most of the space will give you inflation. And this is also something very non-trivial result within loop quantum cosmology, that in fact, actually inflation arises naturally. I have to be very careful. Yeah, I'm not trying to make it very precise. I'm not trying to put a measure on this space. And also, I have taken, you know, as a starting point already, just gravitational degrees of freedom plus a scalar field. So within that context, just by eyeballing it, it looks very like inflation is a very natural thing to happen. Okay, with all those, you know. You can take that statement whichever way you like. But nevertheless, I think it is non-trivial that there's a large set of initial data that lead to inflation. Let's just put it that way. So these are the initial conditions for the background. How about the perturbations? Because if I now give initial conditions at the bounds, you know, at the bounds, my spacetime doesn't look at all like a de Sitter phase, right? So typically in inflation, we use that, hey, you know, inflation is like a quasi de Sitter phase, so we have this vacuum that we can use, the Bunch-Davies vacuum, which is a unique vacuum that is regular and invariant under the de Sitter symmetries. We don't have that one available if you give initial conditions at the bounds. So what to do? Well, there's still, you know, an infinite set of possibilities. But we can at least restrict those possibilities a little bit using the following physical assumptions. We assume that the state is regular, is invariant under the symmetries of the Drest metric, and satisfies the test field approximation. And thereby, I just mean that, you know, the perturbations don't basically backreact on the background curvature such that the dynamics of the background are changed, which is, you know, the same assumption that people make in cosmology as well. But that is essential also for the framework of quantum field theory on quantum space-time to work. So this is an important point. So if I now just take one of these states in here and evolve it with this quantum field theory and quantum space-time framework, what do I get? Well, I get the following thing. This is the power spectrum as a function of different k modes. So yes?
You're just taking the vacuum and evolving that?
Yes. I'm just taking a vacuum state and evolving that forward.
But why would you expect that the universe be in vacuum state to balance?
I mean, this seems like a natural assumption. Why would you put it in the... I mean, why would you put it in the fifth excited state or whatever you want? Well, why is that
bound? But it's balancing cosmology, right? So you have those fields coming in. Why would you? Is there a reason that you might think that it would go into a vacuum?
No, there isn't quite. No. No.
But I mean, typically when you're talking about perturbations,
yeah,
quantizing them, then. If you're asking what state does that describe in perturbation theory, isn't it typically something that's close enough to the vacuum? It's a vacuum plus some lower lying states, and you're not really interested in that. Yeah, but then you could just say why are we using perturbation theory. You can say that.
Well, we're using perturbation theory for a reason, right? Because it just matches observations remarkably well, right? Our universe is practically homogeneous and isotropic. So, I mean, it's not... If we didn't have those observations, I would absolutely object to doing that. But, you know, nature is kind to us. So
usually the argument goes the other way around. Usually you say the Bunch-Davies vacuum is an attractor under inflation. So after inflation, you're almost certainly in the Bunch-Davies vacuum with tiny perturbation, just tiny excitations, which is because you have the dynamics before that expanded everything else.
Away. Yeah, but that requires that there are many, many e-faults. So you have to buy into the assumption that there will be many, many e-faults.
But now you're putting it before inflation. You're selecting the vacuum before inflation. So it is, so Sean's question is really important. Why do you prefer something
over another? Well, I'm still allowing, you know, for this large class, I haven't picked one particular one, but indeed, it is important that the test field approximation is valid. So that's just, I mean, at this point, it is just a restriction on the framework. It's not a, I would say, maybe a physical input or a physical reason that we have.
Okay.
It's just we need to do a calculation, so let's see what we can get out of it. But yeah, it's okay. It's a fair, fair.
You gave an honest answer. You said no, there isn't. But we could do the calculation this
way. I mean, you can give it like, I mean, don't give them too much excitations, but as long as this condition is valid. But I personally wouldn't. Okay, maybe this is my bias, but personally, I wouldn't expect the predictions to change too much if you give them, you know, small in a small excited state. But I mean, I haven't done that personally, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. Any other questions? Yeah, oh, five minutes. Okay, good. So let's look at the result. So what we see here is the nearly scale invariant power spectrum is this black line that we usually get from inflation, and these blue dots are the ones that you get from the framework of using these quantum field theories and quantum space times. And the red line is sort of the average of these blue dots. So the first question is, first observation is, hey, if you look at this average, there is some suppressions on the large scale, so where k is small. That is interesting from a sort of phenomenological perspective, because suppression at the large scales is one of the observed three sigma anomalies. I mean, you can say, oh, this is a three sigma anomaly, it's a statistical fluctuation, but you could also be hopeful that, hey, maybe this is a sign of some primordial physics that we haven't understood yet. Now the question, let me address the question, why are there oscillations in this power spectrum? And that actually is a natural result of the following. It turns out that even though I start with a state that is nothing like the Bunch-Davis vacuum, at all, at the bounds. What happens is that despite all the crazy quantum gravity dynamics and whatnot, at the onset of inflation, even if I have sort of this minimum number of e-faults, at the onset of inflation, the LQC state can be described as a Bogoliubov transformation of the Bunch-Davis vacuum. So now taking the square of this, right, gives me the power spectrum. And what I notice, right, there's this cosine theta term, which is where theta is the angle between alpha and beta. And that is the result for that, that gives you all the oscillations. Now, these other terms here are essentially the number of particles produced during the pre-inflationary dynamics. And that is also the reason why we have these deviations here. Yeah, go ahead. Okay. Well, let me then continue. So now the question is, of course, okay, so there are these deviations at very large scales. Are they observable? And that depends, again, on the number of e-faults that you have. In other words, that depends on the initial conditions that you set. So if I require just the minimum number of e-faults, say I give initial conditions that at the bounds, phi bounds has this value, and phi dot is negative. Then the observable window starts here and basically continues up all the way till where it should end, effectively. So in that case, this suppression is potentially observable. However, it's very, very sensitive to initial conditions. So for example, if I take phi, you know, notice here, 661, 668, it's already, you know, out of the observable range. So in order to really see something from, you know, a quantum gravity regime, we need something that gives inflation, but just not too much of it. Yeah?
The difference between the two pictures.
Good. That here is phi bounds. My initial condition is chosen such that phi bounds is 3.661. Oh, nothing in the picture itself changed. Oh. Just the observable range changed. That's what I'm saying. So the picture, you know, the calculation doesn't really care about this value, and only the observable window basically shifts depending on the initial conditions. So let me see. So this is the power spectrum. Now, if there's one important point is that how crucial was the Sarabinsky potential to all of this? Well, not really. So it turns out that basically all these initial conditions that lead to enough inflation are all kinetic energy dominated. So essentially, they, you know, in the deep quantum gravity regime, they essentially all behave like a massive scalar field. So the predictions for the Starobinsky potential and the quadratic potential in this quantum regime, which, you know, happens roughly like up until 100 Planck seconds, are the same. Now, this, of course, doesn't mean to say that, hey, the quadratic potential and the Starobinsky potential are the same. No, but concerning the corrections that one would get from a quantum gravity area, they are the same. So of course, you know, during inflation, the two are completely different. But from these pre-inflationary dynamics, the predictions are similar. How much time do I have?
-1 minute.
Okay, then I'll skip this and I'll leave up the conclusion slide for you guys. Thank you. Questions?
Yeah, so I wanted to just ask a question about how much of this actually relies on LQG, because I mean, I took your point about the last slide too, that basically, it's the observation that like gravity just becomes kinetic energy dominated near the bounds anyways.
That's not the case. So not all things at the bounds are kinetic dominated, but all that give you enough inflation are kinetic dominated.
Well, I mean, if you believe in the BKL, I mean, there's other reasons why you might think that gravity should be kinetic energy dominated. And if that's the case, then
it's not kinetic domination of gravity, kinetic domination of the scalar field.
Oh, I'm just missing.
Right, you're talking about kinetic domination of phi.
Yes, kinetic energy domination.
Okay.
Of phi specifically.
I was going to make another point. So they kind of really
thank you for clarifying that.
But like, it's the Boogaloo-Bob transformation that he wrote.
Yeah.
Right? So that is basically because as you get close to the singularity, you have like almost BKL limit where all the matter, all the components, everything else is zero except for the kinetic terms of the geometry. And then at late times, you just have cosmological constant domination. And so just very general argument will be that there's an exponential like relationship between those. It's the same reason why, you know, under radiation, right? And
you're translating between two vacuums. So what is happening in the embedded setup is you have basically a pseudo Minkowski set at the bounds, right?
Correct.
And so you're looking at the vacuum compatible with that Minkowski space, and then evolving it and putting it in the Boogaloo-Bob transformation between that and the vacuum compatible with the De Sitter.
Yes. And there's an exponential factor between them, right? The point is that's a fairly you can make that argument fairly general, and so it's not, I mean, that aspect of the thing, I mean, obviously the details that you get will depend on which theory of quantum gravity you have, but the overall picture is somewhat insensitive. If you have a bounds, you'll get this kind of, presumably some of the features are the same. The reason why I bring that up is because of shape dynamics, we also think that we have bounds for different reasons. Well, it's
it expands
from that
point.
There's
no
pseudo
Minkowski state in shape dynamics. It's exactly the opposite.
You've got to assume that near vacuum behavior is the thing that you asked about as well. You want to use the Boogaloo-Bob transformation through the workflow. Because you're saying that I'm translating from one vacuum to the other, and the dynamics is just perturbed around these two vacuums.
Maybe we should talk about that.
Yeah, we should continue this after the break.
There's time for like one more quick question if it's
a bit of a mean question, sorry. Early on, you said that if you have a potential with one of these plateaus, that you can sort of hand wave the probability that you're going to have enough inflation because this plateau goes on forever, you're always going to be above this value. Right? You said above, I think it was 3.66 or whatever it was, yet it not inflation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I not then use the exact same argument to say you're also infinitely likely to have 3.68 or 4? And therefore, you are infinitely unlikely to see a signature of quantum gravity.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So
I mean,
using your result, basically, we're never going to observe quantum gravity if this is intention.
Correct. Yeah, you would need some other physical argument to argue that there is somehow, for some reason, just the minimum number of e-volts, or maybe like 5, 10 more.
Okay,
but that's limited. Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
I did have that. Quick question. So the thing that generates the inflation using this scalar model, do people ever think of, do people try to use that to give the cosmological constant that is present in Alice to some extent, or is that, are those totally disjoint problems?
I think there are people that try to connect them, but I think as of now, I haven't seen a convincing argument that connects the two.
Isn't this the slow roll parameter?
Okay.
Isn't this what they try to achieve through the slow roll parameter?
Wait.
In the, so I think there's a parameter in which they tune to
they try
to do what to say in the potential. But
that's yes. So the kinetic term never dominates, basically. It's just it all the time. Just that it's small enough that Hubble viscosity keeps
during inflation.
Yeah, but that's
cool.